Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture sponsored by the College of Arts and Sciences Alumni Relations. Speaking will be Andrew Basevich, Professor of International Relations at Boston University. Professor Basevich's lecture is titled U.S. Presidential Campaigns in Wartime, A History. We begin with an introduction by Han Han, President of the Arts and Sciences Alumni Board.
I'd like to welcome you this evening to the first lecture in our Arts and Sciences Discovery Series. Tonight's topic is U.S. Presidential Campaigns in Wartime, A History, presented by Andrew Basevich, Professor of International Relations at Boston University. A graduate of the United States Military Academy at West Point, as well as a PhD recipient at Princeton University, Professor Basevich has been a faculty member here since 1998, during which he also served as director of the Center for International Relations from 1998 until 2005. Dr. Basevich has authored and edited several books as well as written numerous essays and reviews that have appeared in various publications. Dr. Basevich has also been a Berlin Prize Fellow at the American Academy in Berlin, as well as a fellow of the Paul H. Nitze School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and the Council of Foreign Relations in New York. Dr. Basevich has been the recipient of numerous awards and grants, including the Moncado Prize given by the Society for Military History and the Arthur Darby Military History Writing Award. Ladies and gentlemen, I present Professor Andrew Basevich.
Well, thank you for the kind introduction. I'm very flattered that so many of you would turn out this evening. It's a real kick. So my task is what I'm going to try to do is probably talk for about 30 to 40 minutes, and that should allow us ample time to have some discussion and questions as soon as I finish. My task is to talk about the history of presidential elections in wartime. I'll talk a little bit about history, but we'll then transition to the contemporary era so we can talk about the ongoing presidential campaign, which is probably what most of us obsess about on a daily basis. Anyway, let me begin by offering this very general proposition, and that is that prior to 1940, war or the prospect of war only infrequently played a central role in presidential elections. Now, historians in the audience perhaps could cite several exceptions to that statement. I'd suggest that probably the principal exception to that statement was the election of 1916, where you'll recall that Woodrow Wilson was running for a second term of office while World War I was raging in Europe. And Wilson ran for re-election on a platform that declared he kept us out of war. And that was sufficient to win re-election in November of 1916. And having won his second term, Woodrow Wilson promptly took the United States into the war. Since 1940, war or the prospect of war has more often than not played a key role in presidential elections. Again, there were some exceptions, and probably the most important exceptions from our point of view as citizens today were the three elections that occurred during the interlude between the end of the Cold War and 9/11. And of those three, especially the election of 1992, when Bill Clinton, a man with very few foreign policy credentials and seemingly an anti-military persona, was able to oust the incumbent George Herbert Walker Bush, who, of course, was a seasoned Cold Warrior. But of these post-1940 elections, the one that I want to talk a little bit about tonight, the one that I think really offers the most suggestive parallels to the situation in which we find ourselves today, is the election of 1952. Then, as now, the incumbent was not a candidate. In 1952, Harry Truman chose not to run because he was so unpopular. Today, George W. Bush cannot run because the Constitution prohibits him from running, although he's so unpopular it's doubtful that he'd have much of a chance either. Then, as now, the nation was caught in a deeply unpopular war. Korea in 1952, Iraq today. Then, as now, the unpopular shooting war formed just one part of a much larger struggle. In 1952, the Cold War, today, the so-called Global War on Terror. But there was also at least one very large difference between the election of 1952 and the election of 2008, and it's a difference I think that we might find instructive. In 1952, the election was not only about Korea, but also about the strategy that the Truman administration had formulated to wage that larger struggle. Today, almost no attention is being given to the strategy that the Bush administration has formulated to wage the global war on terror, and that's unfortunate, in my view. Let me explain. Prior to the start of the Korean War in June of 1950, the Truman administration had committed the United States to a strategy of containment. That is, rather than courting a showdown with the Soviet Union and its allies, we would pursue a policy intended to frustrate the Kremlin's efforts to expand Soviet power. Over the long haul, the United States was counting on the internal contradictions of Marxism-Leninism to cause the Soviet empire to collapse from within. This strategy required that the United States and its allies exhibit great strength, but also great solidarity, and above all, lots of patience. Truman saw the North Korean invasion of South Korea as a challenge to containment. The primary strategic rationale for the U.S.-led intervention in the summer of 1950 was to remove any doubts about the credibility of the containment policy. Now, many of the most important leaders of the Republican Party of that time had very serious reservations about the containment strategy. Their big complaint was that containment didn't solve the problem. It didn't eliminate the Soviet threat. Indeed, in the near term, containment seemed to accommodate the Soviet threat. Republicans found this objectionable from a moral point of view. Containment amounted to tolerating evil, in their judgment. But they also found it objectionable from an ideological point of view. That is to say, the strategy of containment seemed to point to a future of ever larger government bureaucracies, an ever bigger national security establishment, and ever higher taxes to pay for all that, all of those things being anathema to mainstream small government Republicans of that era. The Truman administration's management of the Korean War simply exacerbated these Republican concerns. After the Chinese intervened in Korea in November of 1950, Truman had actually given up any effort to win the Korean War. In essence, we were playing for a tie. And this, the Republicans, and indeed beyond the Republicans, many other Americans, regardless of their political persuasion, this many found difficult to stomach. To make matters worse, in early 1951, Truman had fired Douglas MacArthur, who, of course, had been publicly complaining about the fact that his hands were tied. Well, the firing of MacArthur sent Republicans through the roof, and indeed, very briefly, made MacArthur look like a front runner for the 1952 Republican nomination. In short, for many Republicans, the Korean War affirmed their perception that the strategy of containment was misguided. Rather than accepting endless stalemate, as they saw it, Republicans began to advocate alternatives to containment. One tempting alternative was simply to opt out, to retreat to Fortress America and let others worry about communism and let the world manage itself. A second alternative, radically different from the first one, a second alternative was to get serious about actually winning the Cold War. And this produced talk among Republicans of a strategy of rollback to liberate those who were enslaved by Soviet power. Well, enter Dwight D. Eisenhower. In 1951, Eisenhower was back on active duty. He was serving as the first ever Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, meaning the military commander of NATO, having been appointed to that post by President Truman himself. Now, Ike was popular with Americans for all kinds of reasons. But his immediate appeal at that moment as a potential president derived from expectations that this very famous general might be able to get the United States out of the mess that it was in Korea. When Eisenhower threw his hat in the ring and began to campaign for the presidency, he promised, "I will go to Korea." And people understood that promise as a signal by Eisenhower that were he to become president, that liquidating the Korean conflict would be a very high priority of his administration. Yet it was not really Korea that brought Eisenhower into the race. Rather, it was Eisenhower's larger concerns about the direction and the future of Cold War strategy. Now, Eisenhower, and historians have, I think, really come to appreciate this over the years, Eisenhower was an exceedingly shrewd and sophisticated statesman. He also could be an extraordinarily ruthless operator. And during his many years in the Army, he had also become highly skilled in the arts of politics. In 1952, candidate Eisenhower ran against the Democratic Party. But in another sense, candidate Eisenhower in 1952 ran against the strategic inclinations of his own party, an inclination towards isolationism or an inclination towards rollback. When Eisenhower defeated Adlai Stevenson and became president in January 1953, he rather quickly wrapped up the Korean War, which of course pleased the American people to no end. Yet more importantly, at the same time, during 1953, after going through motions of reexamining basic Cold War strategy, and even as he indulged some of the overheaded rhetoric of his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, Eisenhower actually affirmed the strategy of containment that Truman had devised. Indeed, this had been his intention all along. There would be no retreat to Fortress America. Neither would there be any policy of rollback that might invite World War III. By putting himself at the head of the Republican Party, by capturing the Republican Party, Eisenhower had put himself in a position to be able to forge a new foreign policy consensus that then prevailed in one form or another for the next 3.5 decades. Now, the point of telling this story, we're done with the history part now, the point of telling the story is simply this. In 1952, Eisenhower understood that what really mattered was not the small war, Korea, but the big one, their larger competition with the Soviet Union. This appreciation, it seems to me, is exactly what is missing from the presidential campaign of 2008, and this explains why this election, at least in my judgment, is shaping up to be a missed opportunity. Now, the leading Democratic candidates have a fairly clear position on Iraq. They promised to end that war much as Eisenhower promised to end the Korean War. Senator McCain, the likely GOP nominee, also has a well-developed view on Iraq. He insists that the war must be won, and he vows to continue the U.S. combat mission there as long as is necessary to prevail. In some respects, Senator McCain today has donned the mantle worn by General MacArthur back in 1951, in essence declaring, there is no substitute for victory. Yet much like Korea in the 1950s, Iraq today matters because it came into being. This war was instigated and created as an expression of strategy. Is that strategy sound? Or is that strategy failing and badly in need of replacement? That's the issue, it seems to me, that is not attracting anywhere near the attention that it deserves, either from the candidates or from observers in the media and elsewhere. Well, what exactly is, or was, or has been the Bush administration's strategy for the global war on terror? In its essentials, that strategy has consisted of two components. One component specifies means. The second component describes ends. The most important expression of means is the Bush doctrine of preventive war. The most important expression of ends is President Bush's freedom agenda. Marry the two together, and that strategy, the Bush strategy, can be summarized this way. Through the concerted application of American power, the United States set out in the wake of 9/11 to engineer a fundamental political transformation of the Greater Middle East. Now, Greater Middle East is a term that's never been very precisely defined, but basically it encompasses the Islamic world from North Africa across what we call the Persian Gulf in the Middle East, extending into Central Asia, Afghanistan, and going at least as far as Pakistan, if not Indonesia and the southern Philippines. Just as the liberation of Western Europe in the 1940s also pacified Europe, so too the liberation of the Greater Middle East was expected to pacify that region. Liberation, pacification, call it what you like. Either one would mean that the Greater Middle East, in the eyes of the Bush administration, would no longer breed terrorists intent on attacking the United States. But at the same time, pacification, liberation, would also ensure free access to the region's resources, above all, oil. Now, this strategy, the Bush doctrine of preventive war married to the freedom agenda, rested on three key assumptions. The first assumption was that American power, especially military power, is irresistible. The second assumption is that this huge region called the Greater Middle East is malleable and indeed ripe for transformation. The third assumption is that the United States has a peculiar knack for exporting democracy, with freedom providing the essential antidote to the pathologies found in the Islamic world. Now, here in 2008, it seems fair to say that many observers, to include many Americans, have come to think of this freedom agenda as a cynical proposition that was never seriously intended. I don't entirely agree with that. My own sense is that having had his road to Damascus moment in the aftermath of 9/11, that President Bush himself truly converted to the Church of Woodrow Wilson and truly came to believe that the United States has a mission to spread democracy across the Islamic world. He was a true believer. I'm less persuaded that people like Vice President Cheney or former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld were ever true believers. But when you think about it, the Bush Doctrine Freedom Agenda strategy contains an implicit fallback position. And the fallback position is this, that if the United States proved unable to liberate the greater Middle East, certainly it could control the greater Middle East. In essence, and this is what I believe was reflected in the views of people like Cheney and Rumsfeld, in essence, if democratization proved to be a bridge too far, they still expected that the United States could establish a position of regional hegemony. Or more bluntly, if liberation failed, we'd still be in a position to dominate, and they were willing to settle for that. Now, my own view is that events have demolished all three of those key assumptions that form the basis of the Bush Doctrine Freedom Agenda strategy, and that, therefore, this strategy today is in tatters. Let me review those assumptions again. American power, thought to be unstoppable, turns out to be far more limited than advertised, especially military power, which they counted on as the primary instrument to undertake this program of liberation or pacification. And certainly the Iraq War, which we need to remind ourselves, we are now just weeks away from the fifth anniversary of that war. The events of the Iraq War certainly make the point that American military power is far more limited than the architects of this war expected. Recall that Iraq was intended to be the start of something much bigger, a way station, not a final destination. Operation Iraqi Freedom was supposed to set things in motion. The overthrow of Saddam Hussein was supposed to trigger other advances in the freedom agenda. The reality, of course, is that Iraq has turned out to be a strategic cul-de-sac. We are stuck there. We are stuck with a quasi-permanent dependency that cannot manage its own affairs, cannot defend itself, cannot support itself, and then currently is costing the American taxpayer somewhere between about $2 billion and $3 billion every week. More broadly, the greater Middle East as a whole, this thing that we hope to transform, to liberate, to pacify, the greater Middle East has turned out to be far less malleable than anticipated. And democracy turns out to be quite difficult to export. Now, the difficulty reflects in part what is just the extraordinary, breathtaking ineptitude of U.S. government agencies. But probably to a greater extent, the difficulty reflects the fact that replicating those successes achieved after 1945 in Germany and Japan just turns out to be a very, very difficult proposition in a different time, when dealing with different cultures, when dealing with different religions. And then, of course, in a sense, there's the greatest irony of all, and that is that where democracy seemingly takes root, the spawn poses a danger. We have had a certain amount of democratization in the West Bank, which has brought Hamas to power. We have seen some democratization in Lebanon, which has benefited Hezbollah. And it's hard to see that either of those are very good news for the United States. As a consequence, and again, this seems to me what ought to be at the center of our foreign policy debate in the midst of a presidential election. As a consequence, today the United States is strategically adrift. Now, President Bush is not going to say that. Secretary Rice is not going to say that. Of course, they do say that, in a sense, by their actions. Note that in its twilight days, the Bush administration has reverted to a series of policies that it once openly disdained. The focus is no longer on transforming the greater Middle East. The focus is now on preventing the greater Middle East from falling apart. Rather than denouncing the axis of evil, the administration is now willing, cautiously, tentatively, to talk to members of the axis of evil, both North Korea and Iran. The prior emphasis on democratization has now given way to a renewed appreciation for stability, and the heat is now off. Regimes in places like Egypt and Saudi Arabia to liberalize. A president who once made no effort to disguise his complete contempt for the peace process has now vowed to negotiate peace between Israel and the Palestinians before he leaves office in less than 1 year. Let me make the point plainly. The issue in 1952 was whether to sustain the Truman administration strategy or to choose another course. 2008 finds the United States bereft of a coherent and workable strategy. The challenge facing the next president, the challenge that we should be hearing about from the candidates now, the challenge will be to devise a replacement for a strategy that has self-evidently failed. The Bush doctrine of preventive war doesn't work. The freedom agenda is not going to happen. Now, devising this new strategy promises to be a real challenge because, in large part, because of the errors of the current administration, the next president is going to inherit some very significant constraints. The most important of those constraints, or the most obvious at least, the ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, in neither of which is a favorable outcome likely to occur anytime in the foreseeable future. There's been much talk about the surge as a success. My own judgment would be what the surge has accomplished. It has accomplished something. It has altered a circumstance in which we were heading for clear-cutted defeat and has instead managed to restore a stalemate. And we restored a stalemate basically at the cost of providing arms and bribes to the Sunni insurgents who last year were killing American soldiers. The situation really is not much better in Afghanistan. Afghanistan doesn't get nearly the amount of press. But let's remind ourselves, we're now 6.5 years into that war. Osama bin Laden is still at large, an amazing fact when you think about it. The Taliban is now making a comeback, and in many respects, what began as Operation Enduring Freedom is now well on its way to becoming Operation Enduring Obligation. Barring something miraculous, and it's the Holy Land, so maybe something miraculous will occur, but barring something miraculous, there will be no resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict by the time President Bush leaves office, if only because Mr. Abbas and Prime Minister Olmert are themselves too weak to actually close a deal. And let us not forget the distinct possibility of the real nightmare scenario, and that's Pakistan. The one place on earth that combines a very substantial Islamist presence, along with very weak government institutions, along with nuclear weapons. The new president's going to inherit that as well. Couple all that with sort of the larger secular trends, fading dollar. It's really stunning to think that the greenback is now worth less than the Canadian loonie. Expensive oil, $100 a barrel, weak allies, NATO really is an empty shell, more of a political club than a military alliance. And nearer to home, the new president is going to inherit an army, our army, that is far too small to handle the tasks with which it is burdened, and the new president will really have very few options. Last of all, the new president is likely to inherit a public that is not going to have very much stomach for further military adventures, perhaps expressing itself in a new Iraq syndrome that will sort of serve the function that the Vietnam syndrome did for a decade or so after that war. Now, given this set of problems, inherited problems, the legacy, given the constraints, is it possible to formulate a realistic and coherent approach to strategy? Well, the answer is it has to be. And at least by way of illustration, or you might think of it as a provocation, let me conclude by offering one observer's perspective on what such a strategy might look like. And by implication, I'm suggesting that this is the sort of thing we ought to be hearing from the candidates on. Now, before offering my prescription, let me note that one can approach this question of formulating strategy from two very different points of view. The first approach assumes that the global war on terror should be the primary organizing principle for U.S. grand strategy. That is to say, it assumes that violent Islamic radicalism is the major issue of our time. There is a second approach, however. The second approach questions whether the global war on terror ought to be the focal point of U.S. grand strategy. The second approach acknowledges that violent Islamic radicalism exists and that it poses a threat to the United States, but it sees that problem as falling well short of being existential. This second approach is at least willing to entertain the possibility that other issues, global climate change, proliferation of nuclear weapons, that other issues could possibly provide the focus for rethinking U.S. grand strategy. Right now, just for the sake of argument, I'll adopt the first view. That is to say, I will assume that violent Islamic radicalism does pose the challenge of our time. And in that regard, I'd suggest a possibility of constructing an alternative to the Bush Doctrine Freedom Agenda failed strategy that might be based on the following five principles. First, rather than squandering American power, husband it. As Iraq has shown, U.S. military strength is finite. It's not just military strength, however. The nation's economic reserves and its diplomatic clout are also limited. What we need is a period of time in which we will replenish our strength rather than allowing it to continue to wither away. Second principle, align ends with means. Although President Bush's penchant for Wilsonian rhetoric may inspire some, certainly it sort of warms the cockles of neoconservative hearts, it also raises expectations that simply cannot be met. What we ought to do is to commit ourselves only to objectives that are, in fact, achievable. Third principle, let Islam be Islam. The United States possesses neither the capacity nor the wisdom required to liberate the world's 1.4 billion Muslims, who, by the way, just might entertain ideas about the definition of freedom that differ from our own. Much as the contradictions of Marxism-Leninism were certain ultimately to doom the Soviet Empire, so too Islam will find a way to accommodate itself to the modern world. But Muslims are going to have to decide what that accommodation looks like and how they're going to reach it. Fourth principle, reinvent containment. The process of negotiating that accommodation that I just referred to is going to produce more unwelcome fallout from our point of view. The Islamic world is going to continue to be a source of people who are angry and who are alienated and who will look for scapegoats and who will be willing to employ violence against us. Therefore, in collaboration with our allies, the United States must insulate itself against violent Islamic radicalism. But here the imperative is not to wage global war, whether real or metaphorical. Rather, the imperative is to erect effective defenses as the West did during the Cold War. Defenses don't look the same. We don't need a new NATO. We don't need to send several U.S. divisions to some place to guard the Fulda Gap. But the idea of containment, in contrast to global war, provides the kernel around which we can begin to build a new strategy. Fifth and last, let's exemplify the ideals we profess. Rather than telling others how to live, Americans just might want to devote themselves to repairing their own institutions. And I would argue, in an election year, that revitalizing our enfeebled democracy just might offer the place to start revitalizing our approach to the world. So with that, let me stop, and I certainly look forward to your questions and to your comments. Thank you very much. Yes, sir, front row.
How much of the Bush administration's abject failure in Iraq is due to unbelievable incompetence? You mentioned Japan and you mentioned Germany. Douglas MacArthur and Lucius Clay brought those countries back, and the sense is that they were at least competent. Would Iraq had worked if more competent people had been put in charge?
I mean, obviously we can't say, don't know for sure, but I mean, I'd certainly endorse the basic proposition that it's a striking and it's a puzzling thing. You know, it's a rogues gallery between George Tenet, the director of the CIA, Secretary Rumsfeld in defense, L. Paul Bremer, the first proconsul, General Tommy Franks, his successor, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. It's just stunning the extent to which there was bad judgment compounded by bad judgment, compounded by a refusal to acknowledge reality, compounded by a refusal to adjust to what reality seemed to call for. I think historians will puzzle about this level of ineptitude for a long time. But having said that, it'll be too bad if they limit their analysis to that, rather than probing more deeply to understand why this is such a tough nut to crack. And there I think you do get into matters of history and culture and religion and ethnicity that it seems the Bush administration was blind to. And so if we're going to learn the lessons of Iraq, and we ought to be working real hard to do that, yes, one lesson is don't hire stumble bums and put them into positions of great responsibility. But the other lesson, is we need to understand the complexity of the world, and we need once and for all to get over what has been for at least a century a grave American failing, and that is the assumption that the rest of the world basically is destined to become like us if we can simply nudge them along the right path. Yes, sir.
What would be the risk to the safety of America today if we were to declare victory and leave? After all, we've gotten rid of Saddam Hussein. There are no weapons of mass destruction. There are no atomic weapons there. Why can't we just bring our people home?
Well, if Senator Obama wins, we'll test this hypothesis. I think the answer is that everything that we have done over the course of the last 5 years has now radically transformed the playing field. Now, I myself favor a withdrawal of U.S. troops. But I have to say that I favor a withdrawal of U.S. troops undertaken in a larger context that will include at least some sort of effort to try to contain or minimize the consequences of this terrible failure. I'm not sure that we can contain the consequences all that successfully. Again, the school I come from says we don't have nearly as much power and clout as some people have imagined. But we do have a very large interest in trying to ensure that the instability of Iraq doesn't lead to instability that sweeps across this entire region. And that, therefore, suggests that a strategy of simply let's declare victory and go home would be quite likely incomplete. We have to figure out some way to try to minimize the consequences of what we've done wrong. Yes, sir.
Do you think that our commander-in-chief and his friends gravely miscalculated when they thought that the Iraqi oil fields were going to be easy pickings?
Well, I don't think this is a major issue, but it does seem that they greatly they misunderstood how decrepit and run down was the infrastructure of the Iraqi oil system, company infrastructure, whatever it is. And so getting that up and running has turned out to be far more expensive, time-consuming, and difficult, given the fact that we've had the insurgency going on. So I would just put that as one more item on the long list of things that they miscalculated. Yes, ma'am.
What I hear from all the candidates, the presidential candidates, is the number one issue facing Americans is the economy. Is it naive for me to think that the reason the economy is in such terrible shape is the $2 to $3 billion that we are spending for the war in Iraq every single week?
Well, it's not naive of you, but I think that would be an incomplete explanation of – I'm not an economist, that's for sure. But my explanation, which would certainly include the costs of the war, would look beyond that and focus on some structural problems that have been growing over the course of decades, which we all really know about and all choose to ignore. I mean, the negative trade balance last year went down. In 2006, it was $800 billion. And this past year, because of the weakness of the dollar, I think it went down to $770 billion. Negative trade balance. Stuff we're buying that we're not selling, where we have to borrow money to pay for it. The total national debt, our economy in round numbers is $13 trillion now. Total national debt is now $9 trillion. The proportion of debt to the size of the economy is so great that if we were Argentina, we would have been declared bankrupt years ago. And the debt just keeps going up, and the war contributes to that. The savings rate of the American people is now less than zero. Less than zero. We just are, as individuals and as families, are just, I mean, it's maybe not you, maybe not me, but the country as a whole is just accruing all of this debt. The invention of this day called Black Friday. Black Friday which did not exist when I was a kid. Now, every year, the day after Thanksgiving is Black Friday because the American penchant to consume, not to produce, American penchant to consume has now become the key marker that measures the health of our economy. U.S. oil imports. We consume one out of every four barrels of oil pumped out of the ground around the globe. We have something on the order of 2% of the world's oil reserves here in the United States of America. We are now importing more than 60% of the oil that we consume, and that figure goes up one year after the next year, the next year, the next year, the next year. Can you imagine the truckloads, the shiploads of money that we ship to people like the Saudis? And what's it used for? Well, they buy Mercedes-Benzes and BMWs and they buy big houses. But we also know that they're funneling money to Islamic radicals in order to try to buy them off. So the war is part of the equation that describes the economic fix that I believe we are in, but it's really the tip of the iceberg. And again, the thing I would emphasize is we all know about the problem. We all know that government entitlements are going to become unaffordable. They're going to gobble up the federal budget. We know these things. The politicians know these things. And we just sort of drift along the course that we're on. So what I'm saying is, it doesn't seem to me that simply, and believe me, I am for getting out of this war. But it's going to take more than getting out of the Iraq war to get our house in order in this country, in my belief. Yes, sir, in the back.
You mentioned Saudi Arabia, and that's a demographic time bomb for us, and we're aligning on the wrong side of those demographics. How do you put, do you see that as another large problem in the next generation or so?
I don't understand the demographic reference.
Many young people are unemployed, underemployed, and angry, as in Egypt and other parts of the
Middle East. Yeah.
And we support the House of Saud so we have a steady supply of oil.
Yes. If you look at the Islamic world, I can't cite figures, but youthful population, high level of unemployment, frustration, anger, that's certainly, it seems to me that general picture is an accurate picture. I don't think there's much we can do about it. I mean, I wish there were. And there are certainly people who say, well, if we could just double the size of the foreign aid budget, maybe we could fix these things. I don't think so. A, the problem is too big. B, my own reading of the history of foreign economic assistance is that with certain notable exceptions, like the Marshall Plan in Europe, you don't get much for your money. So I'm too pessimistic, but I mean I begin from the premise that it is not within our ability to fix the world's problems. And therefore, we need to lower our aim, and we're not going to fix the demographic time bomb of the Islamic world. Yes, ma'am.
Hello. I hear what you're saying about how we can't solve all the world's problems. You mentioned in point three, though, of your strategy alternative, that perhaps we should just take on projects that we can handle. And I'm curious as to what you think some of those projects are and why you think that they are doable.
Well, the purpose of the United States, of this union, is described in the preamble of the Constitution. Nothing in the preamble of the Constitution commits the United States to any requirement to try to save the world or spread democracy or do nice to other people. And it doesn't say that because the framers of the Constitution, the founders of this country, were realists. And realism in this context means they had a realistic appreciation of politics, both domestic politics and international politics. And he understood that at the end of the day, like it or not, politics is a struggle for power. Like it or not, nations are motivated to do things in their own self-interest. And that's true whether you're talking about a great power like the United States of America or whether you're talking about, you know, you name it, Paraguay. So we simply should not have false expectations about what we are called upon to do. So what should we try to do? Well, we should do what the preamble of the Constitution says, and that is to try to meet the basic needs of our people and to create opportunities for our people to live as human beings and to pursue, in the words of the Declaration, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to be the best country we can be, to be an exemplar, to show true democracy for others, in the hope that maybe somewhere on the margins we can have a positive influence by doing that. That's point number one. Point number two is we should find it intolerable to live in a dark world where grave criminality is allowed to prevail. There must be things that we say are unacceptable. Rwanda in 1994 ought to have been unacceptable. So there will be times when we're going to need to act to try to address egregious sorts of problems. That's probably about as specific as I can get. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to Boston University Professor of International Relations, Dr. Andrew Bacevich, speaking on U.S. Presidential Campaigns in Wartime, A History. We began with an introduction by Han Han, president of the Arts and Sciences Alumni Board, which sponsored tonight's lecture. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Michael Garth with help from Jim Kiesling. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.